This program is brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute, a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys, professionals, and accountants at the forefront of knowledge and expertise.
Hello and welcome to the Insecurities Podcast, keeping it fresh and staying wonky on the latest securities, regulatory, and enforcement developments with a practitioner's perspective on the stories you should be following. As always, I'm Chris Ekimoff, and I'm here with my co-host, Kurt Wolf.
It is good to be with you, Chris. Always excited to talk about timely topics that are in the news, some things that we've covered in the past here on the Insecurities Podcast. And today we are going to pick up an old thread and talk a little bit about insider trading and a little bit about a somewhat famous, novel case that the SEC brought over the last couple of years, the Panawatt insider trading case.
And yeah, I think we're definitely falling in the fresh bucket for sure, as there were some big developments in the past few weeks on this matter. But I think still wonky, right? We'll kind of fall down the rabbit hole of what is or is not inside trading, as well as, what kind of trading is focused here. And we've got a couple of great guests, leaders in the industry to join us. Everybody wants to hear what the accountant thinks about insider trading law. We definitely have a couple of good folks to help cover that for us today. So just jumping into the backgrounds here, we're joined by Steve Cazares, who is of counsel in Oryx Los Angeles office, where he represents public and private companies and their executives in investigations by the SEC, DOJ, CFTC, FTC, FINRA, and state regulators and prosecutors. Before he entered private practice, Steve spent more than 20 years in government as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of California, and before that, as an enforcement attorney in the SEC's LA regional office. Steve, thanks for joining us on Insecurities.
Happy to be here, Chris and Kurt. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, excited to have you. And of course, you are not alone here on the show today. We have a repeat guest. We're on a run of repeat guests here, Chris. We're happy to welcome Nick Morgan back to the show for the second time. Some of you will remember that he joined us back in August 2023 on episode 99. To talk about the dangers of regulation by enforcement. May or may not be a theme that comes up again today. We'll see. As a reminder, Nick is the founder and president of the Investor Choice Advocates Network, or ICAN, which is a nonprofit public interest litigation organization dedicated to breaking down barriers to entry to capital markets and pushing back against the overreach of the SEC. Since he last appeared on Insecurities, Nick has transitioned to work full-time at ICAN. And before that, of course, he was a partner at Paul Hastings. And prior to entering private practice, Nick was a senior trial counsel in the SEC's Enforcement Division and a special assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of California. Nick, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us here on Insecurities.
Hey, thanks for having me. I had so much fun the first time. Had to come back.
Let's make it maybe an annual thing. I have to say, you guys are absolutely perfect for this show, right? We don't just always kind of go out to the market and find our friends to come and talk about things. You have both actually played an active role in the Panawatt litigation, which is why we couldn't have two better folks come on the program today to talk about some of the key issues from that case.
And in true Insecurities fashion, I think Kurt is still mad at me for making him go over the five elements of revenue recognition under 606 so many episodes ago. Kurt has tasked me with explaining from inception to almost today where we are at with the Panawatt case. So attorneys out there, please forgive me for any misstatements or attempts to be lawyerly in this description. So to kick it off, we had actually talked about this case on our deep dive episode in Insider Trading back in episode 96 in June. But to recap, in August of 2021, the SEC announced insider trading charges against Matthew Panawatt on the last day of the applicable statute of limitations to bring those charges. And generally speaking, as many of our insider trading episodes have covered, to prevail in an insider trading case, the SEC must demonstrate that a trader knowingly bought or sold a security while in possession of material non-public information, or what we'll refer to as MNPI, and made that trade in the breach of a duty or of confidence or trust. Again, generally speaking, we'll get into some of the wonky details here. The SEC's insider trading charges against Mr. Panawatt marked the agency's first ever shadow trading action. Individuals who engage in shadow trading, the theory says, may engage in illicit insider trading when they use confidential information about one company to make an investment decision about the company's competitors or supply chain partners or others in the market. The SEC alleged that Mr. Panawat had confidential information about his employer's impending acquisition by a larger company, and on the basis of that information, he purchased out-of-the-money short-term stock options in one of his employer's competitors, a similarly sized company in the same industry that was also ripe for a business combination, which is in the shadow trading parlance known as a, quote, economically linked company, end quote. Mr. Panawat believed the competitor's stock price would jump when news of his employer's acquisition broke, and he was right. The competitor's stock went up about 7.7% on the news, and Mr. Panawat profited roughly $100,000 on his trading in those options. The SEC alleged that Mr. Panawat's trades involved securities of a third party, and that constituted insider trading. They argued that Mr. Panawat had a duty not to trade in a competitor's stock because of his employer's insider trading policy prohibiting him from using MNPI obtained at work to trade in, quote, the securities of another publicly traded company, including all significant collaborators, customers, partners, suppliers, or competitors of the company, end quote. The SEC also argued that the information was material with regard to the competitor. Various factors tied together the fortunes of these two companies at the time the acquisition was announced, and the information must have been material because the competitor's stock price jumped when the merger was announced. The price went up, the SEC observed, so the venerable, reasonable investor must have considered news of the merger important in making investment decisions, even about that competitor company. Now, Panawat filed a motion to dismiss the complaint, arguing the SEC failed to adequately plead the elements of an insider trading claim. Even if the allegations against him were assumed to be true, Panawat argued, his conduct did not constitute insider trading. In January of 22, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California ruled that the SEC made a sufficient showing to survive the motion to dismiss. The court found that, quote, the SEC's theory of liability falls within the contours of the misappropriation theory and the language of the applicable law, end quote. And they declined to toss the case simply because the SEC was pursuing this new theory. Later, Mr. Panawat filed a motion for summary judgment, again arguing that the SEC had not met its burden of proof. The court denied Mr. Panawat's motion, finding that under certain circumstances, MNPI relating to one company can also be material to another company, even if those two companies do not have a direct business relationship.
Before we get to what's happened this month, right, which was finally a verdict from a jury after trial, I do want to pause and talk a little bit about some things that happened around the motion for summary judgment stage. So, Steve, just starting with you, I want to talk in a minute about what ICANN argued in its amicus brief on the motion for summary judgment. But setting aside ICANN's arguments just for a second, what were some of the issues that Panawat raised at the motion for summary judgment stage? And what did the court find with respect to those arguments?
Sure. Yeah. Panawat basically raised four arguments in the motion to dismiss, and I'm sorry, the summary judgment. But the first being that, you know, in his view, the planned sale of Medivation was already public. Essentially, what he argued was it was already publicly reported that the company was taking bids to be acquired. And based on that fact, he argued that, well, the acquisition was already in the public realm, therefore not material, not public information. He also raised the argument that the competitor firm, in the view of the SEC, Insight, wasn't in fact a comparable competitor. They were differently sized, and there were enough differences in the companies and in analyst views of the two companies to make them not comparable for the purposes of the SEC's argument. He also raised, obviously, like any insider trading case, that he did breach a fiduciary duty to his employer, claiming that the information about Medivation wasn't material to the trading in Insight, and again, raising issues relating to the company's insider trading policy. He claimed that he did not violate because the description of Insight wouldn't necessarily fall within the contours of the company's insider trading policy. And then last, like every insider trading case, he raised scienter arguments based on the facts in the case. You know, obviously the court, because the case did get to trial, the court rejected all of those arguments. But I mean, the facts that he raised for each of these arguments, I mean, are pretty interesting. And, you know, they weren't meritless in my view, and I think in a lot of people's views. You know, the fact that the company was taking bids That's not normal in these type of situations. And that's the kind of argument that any good lawyer would make. The court dismissed it out of hand, citing various facts as to why that didn't matter, including the fact that Insight's stock price rose almost 8% after the announcement of the Medivation deal, which isn't a remarkable bump, but the court cited to it anyway in denying the motion. The court also kind of rejected out of hand the fact that Padawan argued that some analysts didn't necessarily view the two companies as comparable. He just basically, the court said, well, but some do. Therefore, there is a factual dispute necessitating a trial, is essentially what the court said.
And Steve, to pull back from some of the issues about the arguments that were presented by Padawan in the case, Nick, I want to talk a little bit about the ICANN amicus brief that was filed during that motion for summary judgment stage. ICANN informed the court of the unintended consequences of the SEC's novel shadow insider trading theory, and that might allow companies to keep their competitors' stock prices artificially low. What was ICANN's decision to intervene here, Nick, and how did that analysis go?
Well, first, on the decision to file an amicus brief, that was driven largely by the enormous amount of discussion going on in the industry and the SEC defense bar and by market participants raising concern about the implications of this case. So we thought, somebody needs to make the judge aware that there is a discussion beyond the arguments that the defendant is raising. So, and why the summary judgment stage, motion to dismiss, those are really hard to get traction on, particularly on an insider trading case. So that motion to dismiss would seem premature. Motion for summary judgment, kind of the last stop before trial. So it seemed like speak now or forever hold your peace. So, and then as far as the arguments we made, we knew that Padawan was represented by excellent counsel and that those lawyers would make all the arguments Steve just outlined. So we were trying to point out things to the court that would be of interest beyond the arguments that the defendant would make. And so, Chris, you summarized one of those arguments. I think there is a concern about this case by market participants in terms of how far does it go? What trading activity that most people thought was okay are now in question, and what trading will now be chilled as a result of this case? So that was one argument we wanted to make, was that trading on MNPI is not always a violation, and sometimes there are beneficial aspects of that trading for the market. And here, the argument we made was, even by the SEC's description in the case, Insight's stock price, that is the competitor's stock price or the peer company stock price, was artificially low between the time of the Pfizer deal with Medivation when it was consummated and the time the deal was announced. The SEC's point is that information had not been absorbed into the stock price. Therefore, Insight's stock price was artificially low. Trading in the market has a tendency to push prices, if you believe the efficient market hypothesis, has a tendency to push prices in one direction or another. And so trading on the market in anticipation of the Pfizer Medivation deal would tend to push the Insight price in the correct direction, in the direction that reflected the information about the Pfizer deal. So that is an argument we made, that in this case and in other cases, there is a beneficial aspect to this trading on MNPI.
Yeah, it was an interesting point that I picked up on. There were sort of, as I read the brief, there were kind of two big policy arguments that jumped out with me, and then sort of a separate, more legal argument, if you will. But the point about the efficient market hypothesis, one of the things that I think ICANN was arguing is that, look, we don't always view insider trading as harmful or illegal, right? There are lots of different buckets of trading that, if you did a very strict read through the elements of an insider trading charge, maybe you tick the boxes, right? But we just, as a policy matter, are going to say that's not insider trading, right? Whether that's a 10b5-1 plan or whatever it might be. So I don't know, Steve or Nick, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about the thinking here, because what I read in the brief was something like shadow trading, to the extent it's a thing, ought to be in that bucket of, we're just not going to call it illicit insider trading.
Yeah. Steve, I don't know if you want to take this one. I have some thoughts, but.
I guess one of the issues is, just how broadly are the SEC and courts going to view the definition of comparable firms, comparable companies? Because depending on that, I mean, there could be total kind of market-wide bans on trading, essentially. Now, if a company's business relies on advertising, are you a competitor to every company in the market that relies on advertising? That seems pretty tough, pretty broad. And to me, that seems like a problem that really can't be defined. And that's really one of the issues at the core of our brief that, you know, look, I used to be a regulator. I used to work at the SEC, at the DOJ. I understand the thinking on the enforcement side. And the thinking is always push the boundary to the most aggressive position. I mean, that's what they do. That's essentially their job. But the problem from the defense side is, well, how do you respond? How does a general counsel at a public company, you know, respond to that potential reputational and other risk to their company and executives? It's a real problem.
And picking up on that, Steve, the problems of defining the boundaries of this, one of the policy arguments that we tried to make in the brief was, okay, if you were going to sit down and you were going to say, okay, we're going to allow a company to restrict its employees trading in our competitors, our suppliers, our collaborators, however you want to define it, you're leaving the definition of the boundaries of the trading up to the company to define. And particularly in this case, where Medivation is restricting its employees from trading in a competitor's stock, that has a whiff of anti-competitiveness about it that struck us as a bad policy. If you were going to design a policy, you know, from, you know, a blank slate, are we going to allow companies to define the contours of the misappropriation theory by virtue of their internal control documents to restrict their employees from trading in competitors' stock? Where it may, that struck us as a bad policy, and that's kind of the policy that this case backs into.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, these two policy arguments set up nicely more of the legal argument, again, as I read it, which is, hey, SEC, there's a lot of bad stuff that could happen if you're going to interpret the insider trading restrictions in this way. And if that's what you're going to do, you should let us know, or you should do it in a different way, right? So you said in the back half of the brief, ICANN argued that, quote, the court should not impose shadow trading liability in this case in the absence of clear congressional delegation of authority to the SEC, which does not exist, end quote. And again, I think what you're saying is, if this is what you want to do, then make a rule or put us on notice. But don't wait till the last day of the statute of limitations with some individual to sort of announce this new theory that you're going to, you know, kind of put in your tool chest. So I don't know if I've got that right. You know, Steve, maybe you want to jump in there, or Nick, and talk a little bit about the delegation of authority issue.
Nick?
Well, Kurt, you predicted we would utter the words regulation by enforcement. Well, it has now come. So, yeah, I mean, the SEC, if it wants to shift directions, policy directions, or move in a new policy direction, by far, in my view, the preferable, most transparent way to do that is through rulemaking. The SEC has done rulemaking around insider trading in the past on a number of different issues, so it's capable of doing it. If you believe the director of enforcement's view of this case, this wasn't a novel change in direction or a novel direction, so rulemaking was unnecessary. But I think, judging from the reaction from the market and the legal, the SEC defense bar and others, there's just no question this was a new direction. And, you know, this is an area where everyone would benefit from having a proposed rule that we can all look at, we can take shots at, we can argue about whether there's statutory authority for the rule, how far should it go, how, you know, and that didn't happen. So we have a case-by-case analysis of that policy, which in my view, you know, it's going to end up turning on this jury, on the appellate court, and we won't get a broader discussion of the issue.
Steve, did you want to jump in there?
You know, no, I mean, I agree with all of that. And the other, I guess, related issue is, you know, that SEC is the civil side and the DOJ tends to follow suit at some level. And, you know, the problem there is on the DOJ side, and they haven't done this yet, but, you know, they're not limited to Title 15.
Right.
You know, they can use, you know, the wire fraud statute 1348, where the elements are a little more flexible, one could argue, and you don't necessarily have the breach of fiduciary duty issue verbatim and well-defined on the criminal side. So, you know, this theory, to the extent there isn't specific rulemaking, it kind of leaves some exposure on the criminal side that is even more undefined and risky for individuals.
Certainly more risky. I mean, it's hard, at least for me, to imagine someone facing potential criminal liability for this kind of market conduct. But you're right, that is conceivable if this SEC theory is going to succeed. And so I guess we should test it, right? So we're going to bring this story current. As of just a few weeks ago, based on when we're recording this episode, the Panawat matter is now concluded. On Friday, April 5th, 2024, a San Francisco jury found Mr. Panawat liable for insider trading under a misappropriation theory of insider trading. The jury reached its verdict after an 8-day trial, but on less than 3 hours of deliberation. I wasn't in the courtroom, but sort of reading through some of the reports, it sounds like the SEC actually presented a lot of interesting, a lot of new, and in some cases compelling, in some cases not, evidence, including showing jurors evidence that Mr. Panawat bought stock options in Insight just 7 minutes after his employer's CEO sent an email saying that Pfizer was ready to sign a deal to buy Medivation. I'm highlighting this because based on the reports I've read, this really seems to have moved the jury, this sort of closeness in time between the CEO saying, hey, here, you know, the deal is done, and Mr. Panawat going out and buying stock. That said, Mr. Panawat's attorneys argued that he received hundreds or thousands of emails around the time that the merger was closing. But the SEC is sort of presenting the facts in a false light by just focusing on this one email. I don't know. That's just something that jumped out of me. Obviously, there's been a ton of evidence that was introduced at trial. So, Steve, I don't know if anything jumped out at you in terms of the reporting or any of the evidence you're aware of that came out during the 8-day trial.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the email was really central. It was described as the hung email, which is the executive who circulated the information that then apparently Panawat, according to the SEC, used to then trade. And some of the interesting facts that were introduced around that is, one, the SEC didn't necessarily have metadata to show that Panawat actually opened the email, that they were able to establish receipt, but that's not necessarily enough. And they really pushed heavily on the fact that, well, Panawat was sending and receiving emails that day. Therefore, he must have seen the email and used that information. It's a fair inferential leap. And in a civil case, you can understand why maybe they were given the benefit of the doubt. But, I would have thought if I was on the SEC side, you would have gotten the metadata. Maybe the metadata didn't show that he opened it. So they basically avoided that issue. I thought that was an interesting fact. The other fact I thought was interesting was Panawat did decide to testify, which is a really tough decision. But again, in a civil case, you almost have to. You can't not take the stand because the inference is too negative. And he, according to the reports at least, I didn't see the transcript, he apparently didn't really have a good explanation for why he traded that day. And in fact, in the SEC testimony, which apparently some of which was introduced, he couldn't explain it. He basically, I don't know. I don't remember why I bought the options. And that is always really difficult. If he could have come in strong with, I saw X reports, I was following an analyst, which is oftentimes what happens in these sort of cases. I've tried insider trading cases where the defense brings in, look, I received X analyst report, 3 days before I traded. That's what I relied upon. And that can be a good, strong defense. Apparently, Panawat didn't have any of that or little of that in his defense. So that seems to have probably kind of pushed a jury over the edge. I don't know, Nick, if you had any thoughts.
Well, on the materiality point, and Kurt, the point you raised about the 7-minute interval between the CEO's email and the trade, the materiality standard is meant to be objective. What would a reasonable investor find important to making a decision? A challenge for defense counsel on materiality is keeping the objective materiality test separate from the actual subjective conduct of the person. So if I'm a juror and I've just heard that, I've heard from an expert witness, an economics expert who talks about the share price movements on it. And then I'm considering, did this person, did Panawad find it important to his investment making decision? That's not meant to inform the objective test, but a juror is going to confuse those two things, I think, and conclude that, well, if you traded 7 minutes after getting this email, you must have thought it was material, therefore it must be material. So I think it's a very challenging fact pattern for a defendant because it muddies the materiality standard. It was interesting, the defense also made the argument that the CEO's email did not conclusively say the Pfizer deal was going to happen. It said there was, I think the phrase was, Pfizer had overwhelming interest in the transaction. And on the materiality standard, one of the famous sort of rules of thumb is you look at the probability of the event happening and compare it to the magnitude of the event. And so here, this happens all the time where a deal is in its infancy, it's less material. If it's about to happen, it's more material. So that's at least a somewhat helpful fact on materiality for the defense that it wasn't a done deal yet. But obviously it did then happen pretty shortly thereafter. So it's tough to get around.
That 7 minutes to me is so interesting because it is, I mean, you can imagine a hypothetical classic case of email received minute two, minute three, that happens. Like, was there something in Mr. Panawat's Amazon shopping cart that he purchased before he went and did? I can imagine a lot of like theories and discussions about, you know, where the mindset was of anyone who's alleged to have insider trade along that way. But when you get back to that metadata of the email too, you know, was the individual paying attention to other things instead of this? And like you said, had gotten up that morning and had thought to trade, and then this email just happened to come in. Seven minutes is just, it's a strange number to me. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, I can tell you it's sort of, in my experience, it's right out of the SEC's playbook. I've had a few insider trading cases over my career where they're trying to tick and tie phone records and text messages and emails and just, you know, do a minute by minute chronology to say, right, you must have traded on the basis of that information. Because look, like you learned it on minute one and you traded on minute 9, 12, 24, you know, whatever it is.
Well, it can be compelling. Yeah, to that point, what's the right amount of time to wait? 37 and a half minutes and then you get out of that suspicion? I want to know where that line is, Kurt.
I think when you're arguing the timeline, you're probably losing. That's my own view, right? You need to be talking more about the substance of the information.
Understood.
Did it matter? Is that, you know, anyway, I mean, but you got two other lawyers here who can weigh in and tell you what they
Is there about. A bright line of time period to wait after the email, Steve or Nick? I'm guessing there probably isn't.
There probably isn't. You take the extreme case where, you know, they receive information months before. Hmm. And then they have a trade. And, you know, the SEC has brought those cases, but it becomes so attenuated. But, you know, the difference between 7 minutes and 37 minutes.
Got it.
Well, they also tend to argue, even when there are kind of banal intervening facts between the receipt of the information and the trade, that in some way that was planned as the defense. I mean, I've seen mm-hmm. that done as well. Well, of course, they waited. They made calls to other people in order to build in a defense. So it's almost you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Understood. So we've got a guilty verdict in this trial. I've been around the law profession enough to know that the cases don't end with a guilty verdict, right? In your opinion, Steve, what's next for Mr. Panawat? Is he likely to appeal? You know, what kind of process might be moving forward?
He is likely to appeal. What one would think. He has, you know, again, top flight defense counsel in his pocket, in his corner. It's a tough road to hoe, you know, when you have a jury verdict. Ultimately, what are you going to hang your hat on? I'm not sure there are issues with the jury instructions, things like that, or whether there was evidence or defenses that were excluded. I don't recall whether that came up. But obviously, you know, the appeal will go to the core issue of whether or not information relating to Medivation was material to Insight. I mean, that has to be essentially issue number one, you know, because that is arguably incorrect that the court, you know, basically should have killed this baby in the crib, then, you know, he's good to go. Beyond that, I think the facts and the issues get more difficult on appeal. But, you know, he has many arguments to make.
Yeah, well, I agree that he's likely to appeal. An issue that I think we might see on appeal relates to some of the jury instructions, particularly around, you know, what duty is owed to the employer, if any, and whether it matters, you know, what his employment contract said, or is there just a general duty, right? But it seems the instruction that I read is very SEC friendly. And so who knows, maybe we'll end up getting to do this whole thing over again. We'll have you guys back after the second trial. But I want to talk a little bit sort of about policy or what's going to happen, what's going to happen next. You know, Nick, we've mentioned a couple times that the SEC insists this is not a novel theory, right? And right after the jury's verdict was announced, the SEC's director of enforcement came out and gave a statement, and he said this was, quote, insider trading, plain and simple, end quote. So Nick, this is like wheat and potatoes for you, but, you know, do you agree?
What a softball, Kurt. That statement was, I mean, first of all, look, the director of enforcement, super smart in his statement. Oh, yeah. It's clearly done intentionally to signal that this case fits within the existing legal framework. And so I understand why he said it. It's just not accurate. I mean, this is clearly a new direction. It's got all kinds of implications. And so if Mr. Panawat decides not to appeal because, say, he can't afford counsel, well, then he should talk to ICANN because, you know, we will appeal it.
Nice plug. Nice plug.
We'll put the website in the show notes.
But, you know, there is such interest in this issue that I think that the director of enforcement statement is best understood to be nice packaging around a successful jury verdict, not an actual reflection of the state of the law on this issue.
I think we've done a good job of kind of summarizing and talking about the issues that have been seen throughout this case, and there'll be more to come. We'll do the part two of this episode in the months or maybe years to come, as Kurt referenced. But for our listeners, I think there might be more to consider here than just kind of Mr. Panawat's activity and the SEC's response to it. If I'm an issuer, if I'm out there, you know, in the market participating, running my business, and I'm worried about some of the issues that may be happening with my folks, if I'm an in-house attorney or a compliance professional within one of those businesses, what kind of ideas or understandings or things can I take from the Panawat case to maybe shore up my own shop to make sure that these things don't happen or respond to them in the right way?
Well, so issuers very rarely encounter liability for insider trading by their employees. And that was the case here. Nobody suggested Medivation had any exposure. So I think maybe counterintuitively, one thing issuers want to think about is how broad do they want their insider trading policies to be? There was some expense for Medivation to hire counsel. I'm sure they had to provide a bunch of records. I'm sure there was testimony. Had there, and again, this is a little counterintuitive, and I can probably say it because I work at a nonprofit. If had their insider trading policy not restricted trading in competitors, would we be here?
Right.
And what benefit did Medivation get from that restriction? I don't know. It's none. So that, you know, one thing to consider is maybe less is more in this context. But, you know, I think probably the actual reaction from most issuers will be, oh, we need to beef up our compliance. We need to, monitor, get more input from trading activity by employees. You know, it'll be to go in the other direction to have a more expansive, broader, beefier compliance program. That'll probably be the most common reaction, I think.
Do you agree, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I do. It's the problem is the insider trading policy was an important fact and central to the case, but as a legal matter, it doesn't define the parameters of insider trading or 10b-10b-5. It's just one fact. It's one data point. And I think Nick is right. Companies are likely to respond by attempting to restrict employee and executive trading. I mean, he used options here in this case, which is, obviously a means of leveraging finances to get the biggest bang for the buck on your trading. And that's central to inside trading cases. I mean, you could simply, as one fact, just eliminate, the use of options by your employees and executives. It's speculative. Maybe they shouldn't be doing that anyway. They're likely to impose, like Nick suggested, impose kind of pre-clearance policies, maybe. And that's what the SEC does for their employees, which is why a lot of employees don't do much trading, because you had to get everything cleared ahead of time. And that's a way to limit some of the cost, maybe. It's purely reputational and cost for the company. But, on these big cases, that could be quite expensive. And you might have indemnification policies for the executives. So, they may have to front defense funds at some level, depending on what the allegations are. So it's not a zero cost issue for the company, despite the fact that they don't have legal exposure.
Yeah, I work at a large accounting firm. And, you know, any accounting firm on the high end of the size and spectrum is very focused on the requirements for pre-clearance and tracking systems and all of that. So from a compliance perspective, I totally agree. But I'm interested, too, in kind of the way that the policy was written in this matter. Is that something that you all have seen kind of being a standard in the industry? Or is it just straight boilerplate language? Or is this a really focused policy? Where on that spectrum did we see this document falling?
I think if there's a bell curve of policies, mm-hmm. this is right down yep. the middle. Not every company does it this right. way, for sure. But it's not an outlier gotcha. Either. Oh. Yeah.
So it sounds like we've got some more to come on this one, Kurt.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. And I'll put it to you, Nick and Steve. But what's next, right? The SEC must feel emboldened, right? They just got a big win after an 8-day trial. You know, Steve, of course, you sort of noted that the DOJ is probably watching with interest. But do we think we're going to see more shadow trading cases, right? I mean, this can't be the only one that the SEC has its eye on. So what do we think is going to happen next?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to say because to identify, trading in this manner in companies and to tie together, a competitor, an executive. I mean, it's one thing to identify unusual trading in an issuer and then go attempt to, blue sheet it and attempt to identify their executives in the trading of the stock on X day. But to then, backtrack and identify everybody and everyone's background who's trading on a particular day, it seems to me that it's more work, would take more time, which is maybe why they waited for the last day of the statute of limitations in this case to get it done. And knowing how the SEC works, they don't work very quickly anyway. So I'm not sure that this is going to become a routine type of case, but it's not going to go away. No. So, to the extent you've got other instances where you have big bumps, it gives the staff a reason to dig further and spend more time, which if you're a company or if you're on the defense side, is never necessarily a good thing that they're digging deeper and spending more time because you're bound to find something, which is another problem. While they're digging, looking for this, sometimes yeah. regulators identify other issues. So you inadvertently find yourself within their crosshairs. So that's a problem as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't see a flood of these cases being brought, but I do think there'll be a lot more investigations around it. And I do think that there will be some chilling of market activity as a result.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, it's not a stretch to imagine how they could weave this into their investigative workflow, right? They've been, FINRA and the SEC have been using, big data for years to try to find anomalous trading, largely to identify insider traders, right? I assume a way that they do that is they see anomalous trading in a certain name and they figure out who it is. And they're like, oh, aha, that person works at ABC Co., right? Let's take a look at that. I mean, is the next step to see some anomalous trading and say, oh, aha, this person also works at a pharmaceutical company, I'm sure that you can program for that and sort of build it into the workflow, but man, that's a lot of resources.
It is.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here. I think it's been a good conversation, even if everyone here agrees kind of on where this case falls and what may happen next. But there'll definitely be some follow-up here. And thankfully, you've all been voluntold to appear on a future episode to discuss those things. So we...
Panawatt 2 coming right, to a podcast near you.
Happy to do it, guys. Thanks a lot. Right,
thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Insecurities Podcast. And a special thanks to our guests, Steve Kazaris of Oric and Nick Morgan of ICANN. We always love to hear from our listeners. Look for us on social media to share your thoughts and comments or topics you'd like us to explore on future episodes of Insecurities. Please use the hashtag InsecuritiesPod on X or LinkedIn to join the conversation. You can find me at EkimoffCPA.
And I'm at Enforce_update.
Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review Insecurities wherever you listen. Be well, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Insecurities, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is a nonprofit provider of authoritative professional services training and continuing education. In an increasingly complex business environment where intricate corporate structures reign, Insecurities can help you make sense of it all. A special thanks goes to the producer of Insecurities, Daniel Pinitz, as well as hosts Chris Ekimoff and Kurt Wolf. For more information about PLI's SEC Institute, or to view hundreds of hours of fresh and relevant on-demand programming covering changes within the security sector, visit pli.edu/membership and sign up for a privileged membership. These recorded materials are designed for educational purposes only. This podcast does not constitute legal, audit, tax, consulting, business, financial, investment, or other professional advice, and it does not create an attorney-client relationship. Please consult a qualified professional advisor before taking any action based on the information herein. Furthermore, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual participants. These views are not the views of the hosts or their employers. Users of this podcast may save and use the podcast only for personal or other non-commercial educational purposes. No other use, including without limitation, reproduction, retransmission, or editing of this podcast may be made without the prior written permission from PLI.